This is Jim Inkster coming today. On the show, we are slated to hear from Kevin Kane. He is with the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. He founded this group in 2008. And Kevin Kane has some thoughts about the rising prison population in Louisiana. The population of inmates in our state has nearly doubled in 20 years. Also on the show, Joe Henry. His book is Richard Pryor, Furious Cool. Pryor was the most free black man of the 20th century. That's from Dr. Cornel West, and he was also a comic genius. And Dr. Diane Roberts Stoller, coping with concussion and mild traumatic brain injury. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Wherever you may be, the toll-free number is 877-217-5757. And if you're dialing locally, it is 297-5633. In just a moment, we'll hear from Kevin Kane, president of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy, with some ideas about why Louisiana's prison population has all but doubled in the last two decades. But we start with Diane Roberts Stoller. Her book is Coping with Concussion and Mild Traumatic Brain Injury. In 1990, Dr. Diane Roberts Stoller's life changed in the blink of an eye. She incurred a concussion after being involved in a 60-mile-per-hour head-on automobile accident. Although outwardly she suffered only minor cuts and bruises, she found herself fighting to gain her old self, suffering many of the symptoms of post-concussion syndrome. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Nice to talk to you, Dr. Stoller.
Nice to talking to you.
Well, let's go back 23 years. What happened to you when you had your automobile accident?
Well, the key is that back then, and this is for your listeners that is so important, back then they did not know of the term neuroplasticity, that the brain can heal itself. And I was told my accident was in 1990, and there's two parts that's also very key. I had the accident and then later had brain surgery. So there was repetitive injuries within a very short time, which is called second impact syndrome. So the injuries of post-concussive syndrome, not only were one plus one, but because of the repetitiveness, they were exponential. And so the symptoms were really very horrific. And in 1994, I was told by every doctor in the Massachusetts area that I went to that I was permanently brain damaged and I would never learn to walk, talk, or do anything again. And the fact is that because of neuroplasticity and because I am a neuropsychologist and this is what I did for a living, I started healing myself. I figured out a program, and that program is in the book. It talks about every single method that someone can use for every single symptom of post-concussion syndrome.
Well, some would have thought that in 1990 it was well known that the brain has the capacity to, as you say,
absolutely
heal
not
itself.
As a matter of fact, a year ago, there was a client in New York City who got injured and went to a very prominent neurologist in New York City, and the doctor said, once your brain is like a tomato, once it gets squished, it cannot be repaired. And that is not true, and that's what people need to know.
So you had a manifestation that, as you say, was quite horrific, even though you didn't break a lot of bones, as some of us have done in car accidents. How quickly did it take before you started making progress and coming back?
For me, it took 7 years to learn to walk, talk, and do everything. And then I got better. And then in 2008, a snowplow hit the front of my car, and I had another concussion. And that one took only about 3 months to regain back, and I was able to go back to work. And then in 2010, I was sitting in a zero gravity chair, and the hinges snapped, and I had another concussion. And that took me about a month and a half. So the methods of changing your diet, getting restorative sleep, exercise, and for each symptom, and all the symptoms are on my website of drdiane.com, they of post-concussion syndrome, and there's not just of a concussion. It's also if you've had a stroke or MS, any kind of brain injury, there's a cluster of symptoms from physical symptoms such as headaches, nausea, light sensitivity, to cognitive, which, you know, when you think of memory problems or word-finding problems, is trying to listen to someone and trying to process what they're saying, emotional problems and behavioral problems. And, you know, and you can have a concussion and all these symptoms from not what is so apparent of having a head injury, such as sitting in a car and getting a whiplash.
A licensed psychologist and neuropsychologist, Dr. Diane Roberts-Stoller, has written a book about her experiences and others coping with concussions and mild traumatic brain injury. What are the long-term consequences of this?
Well, if you address it immediately, is your brain typically heals within 4 to 6 weeks. It's when it does not, then you're seeing something that probably you've had a prior injury, and that this is when the book will absolutely, depending, it's almost like going to an encyclopedia. It has explains the different ways of diagnosing, the different treatments, but then specifically the going to your symptoms, and it tells you, has a true story in it, how it's diagnosed, and then conventional methods, complementary methods, and alternative methods, along with practical suggestions of how to regain your life based on the symptom you're occurring.
Do you face a greater risk of dementia down the line?
Not necessarily, no. Dementia is an aging process, but if you do some of the methods that's in the book, you can actually circumvent some of this, because by exercising, getting a proper diet, some of my patients, I actually, in my practice, I have brain rehabilitation and brain fitness. So someone who is like yourself, who's maybe never had a concussion, and
I've had them, believe me.
You've had it.
Including one very big one.
Did you?
Yeah.
And so you may still have some symptoms that can be improved upon. This is what, because of the neuroplasticity, what we used to be thinking, well, I had it 10 years ago, nothing's going to help me now. The fact is there's now methods that can help you. Absolutely.
Well, the book is Coping with Concussion and Mild Traumatic Brain Injury, A Guide to Living with the Challenges Associated with Post-Concussion Syndrome and Brain Trauma, from Diane Roberts-Stoller. We thank you for joining us this morning, Dr. Stoller.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're joined in studio now by Kevin Kane, who is with the group that he founded in 2008, the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. He is the president. A lot of P's in there. From the man whose name is KK, Kevin Kane. Hope your middle name doesn't start with a K.
No, it starts with a P.
Okay. Graduate of Tulane and Loyola School of Law, and a fellow at the Loyola Institute of Politics. He's a man who follows the political scene quite intricately, and we've talked with Kevin about Louisiana politics, and we're talking about something now that transcends politics, the prison population in the state. Over the last several decades, Louisiana lawmakers have passed a number of sentencing laws aimed at reducing crime and incapacitating certain types of offenders. Because these laws have been disproportionately applied to nonviolent crimes, nonviolent offenders now account for the majority of inmates to prisons in the state. So, Louisiana, which had 21,000 inmates in 1992, now has about 40,000. So, you're a man who is a law and order kind of guy, but you see some problems with this. Why so?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Jim, and thanks for the opportunity to come here and chat about this. I mean, most people know, or certainly most listeners to your show, I'm sure, aware of the fact that we have the highest rate of incarceration of any state in the country. And what's interesting is that a lot of other states around the country have been taking steps in recent years to address that issue and to lower their incarceration rates.
We had the highest level, I think, in 1992 before all this. Now, that's a substantial increase, almost double, in 20 years. And you're saying it's primarily because of these laws.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the people who are in our jails and what has really driven that increase, it's, you know, there was in the 80s and 90s a push for tougher drug laws. You remember the whole crack phenomenon epidemic in the 80s, and there was a really kind of a bipartisan push for stronger drug laws in that time period. And so nationally, we saw a great increase in incarceration rates. But over time, I mean, more states have started to look at that and really think about, is it necessary to put drug users away for that long?
So most of these nonviolent people who are in our prisons, it's a consequence of drug laws.
It's, you know, drug and property crimes, but I think drug laws have really fueled a lot of that. You know, the mandatory minimums attached to nonviolent crimes and then habitual offender laws. And so as a consequence, I think we've got a lot of people who are incarcerated who've done something wrong, need to be punished, but not necessarily for as long as we're putting them away for.
Is there any evidence that the laws have reduced crime in any way?
Well, of course, that's, you know, it's not, it's an imprecise science trying to determine what kind of, policies impact crime rates. I mean, crime rates have declined. How much of that can be attached to these laws is subject to debate. Personally, I think I think that good policing and a number of other factors are ultimately more important to keeping crime rates low than putting a drug user away for 30 years.
297-5633 is your number. Kevin Kane, who is president of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy, is with us. Rinaldi in Sherwood. Rinaldi, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Very to-the-heart topic on this. Thank you so much for doing the show about it. Jim, in Louisiana, we have what some of us call the military, the prison industrial complex, and that a lot of these nonviolent offenders are in jail, but the state of Louisiana is making $25 a day per prisoner. Now, for some of us, this is a waste of taxpayer money for people who have, you know, low offenses for, you know, marijuana possession or going into Walmart and stealing a TV set. So the important point that I just want to make about this is this, too. When you put these guys in jail and they come out of jail with felony convictions, then they, you know, they're sort of like mutants in society. They can't vote. They're not full citizens. And then we end up placing them in a position where they can't go out and get a job because they run a background check. It's like, oh, you're a convicted felon. We can't hire you. So then the person is, you know, they can't benefit from any social programs, and so they're left almost on the street. So then guess where they end up? Back in jail.
Well, that's, you know, you've touched on some really important points. And this particular study, Smart on Sentencing, Smart on Crime, and I should mention that we published this along with the Reason Foundation and the Texas Public Policy Foundation. This study really focuses more narrowly on the question of sentencing laws. However, when you look at the criminal justice reform issue as a whole, I mean, you have to look at it much more broadly, from everything to kind of pretrial services and bonding and how we deal with people when they're first arrested, to the sort of end of the process, which he's talking about, kind of reentry. How do we make it easier for people to reintegrate back into society, to get jobs and to become functioning members of the community and be less likely to end up back in prison? So, you know, this paper focuses on sentencing, but we're really looking at the whole issue, and we're going to be putting out more papers on some of these other issues that are very important as well.
297-5633, your number as we talk to Kevin Kane, and he'll be with us for a while longer, president of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. Now, Kevin is a conservative, and he is advocating some changes that would result in some people who are in jail getting out of jail, or at least getting out earlier. And this is an issue that has turned the political spectrum inside out. I see a headline here, Jerry Brown vetoes modest drug policy reform. He's a noted liberal, but usually these politicians, they don't want to be perceived as being soft on crime.
Sure, sure. And with good reason.
Go ahead.
You know, again, I think on some of these nonviolent crimes, you're really seeing broad bipartisan support for some of these reforms, and I think that trend is going to continue.
We'll return with Kevin Kane after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Kane, president of the Pelican Institute on Public Policy, is with us. And he and his group have come forth with a study on Louisiana's prison population. And it shows that in 1992, when Edwin Washington Edwards was governor, 21,007 people were in our prisons, which at that time was the highest rate in America. And today it's 39,709. In fact, that figure is from about a year and a half ago. That's a $315 million increase in correction expenditures, in addition to the fact that many people who may be productive members of society are locked up and unable to be in the society where they could produce. It's an issue, Kevin, that has widespread impact on our culture at large.
It does. I mean, when you look at the impact on families and communities when people are sent away for an extended period of time, and again, it's not to deny that folks who've broken the law shouldn't face consequences from that, but the really harsh and stringent law punishments for nonviolent criminals, I think, has some spillover effect that is not good. And I think what's really interesting about this is the fact that conservative organizations and conservative political figures are really starting to embrace this issue. This first came onto my radar several years ago. I was at a conference where there were people from different think tanks around the country, and on the agenda there was a panel featuring some folks from Texas who were talking about the successes they had with the issue of criminal justice reform. And I was frankly a little skeptical at first, but I thought, well, criminal justice reform, that's, you know, the ACLU and people who think that the police are all racists who are engaging in that issue. But when I sat and listened to them present on this issue, it really struck me that maybe some of our laws, our sentencing was not really appropriate, and there were opportunities to address this. And when you look at the costs involved, what we're spending on incarceration is remarkable, and ultimately it's not sustainable. So over time, we've seen states like Texas is kind of known as the ultimate law and order state, and for decades they've been building more prisons to accommodate their ever-growing population. And finally, they just reached a point where they said, this is enough. And so they've started enacting these reforms, and they're now actually at the point where they're closing prisons. And I think that's pretty remarkable.
Shaw on Segan Lane. Shaw, good morning. You're on with Kevin Kane.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Ken, I've recently been reading Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath. And could you address... he refers to the inverted U-shaped curve and talks about the percentage of children who grow up with parents in prison, the likelihood of them becoming felons in their own lifetime.
Right. Well, not having read it, I can't talk to the specifics of that, but there's no question that the impact of having a parent in prison must be traumatic. And actually, just recently, I was touring the facilities at the Hunt Correctional Center not far from here. And they have a men's facility and a women's facility. And going through the women's facility, it was kind of striking. I mean, I think we're used to seeing, kind of if you're watching a movie or something and there's a prison scene, it's always men. And so to go to a women's prison and see hundreds of women in the jumpsuits and in out in the prison yard was really striking, and then to find out that what a high percentage of those women have children, and I just I can't imagine what the impact of that must be on their children and the long-term fortunes of their family.
Your number is 877-217-5757 for Kevin Kane, who is taking aim at Louisiana's high rate of incarceration. 868 of every 100,000 people in our state in prison. That's about one, do the math on that. That would be 1,000 for 100,000, about one for every 100 people in our state are in jail. And when you think about men, the rate is much higher.
Right.
It's probably more like one out of about every 60 or 70 males in Louisiana.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. And again, I mean, you know, given the dramatic increase in incarceration rates, we're not seeing a commensurate improvement in the crime rate.
297-5633 is your number. Kevin Kane drove in from the great city of New Orleans to be with us this morning. HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on the air with Kevin.
Good morning. Mr. Kane, in my career of police work, we've always said or thought that we've heard the statistics that only 10% of the people commit 90% of the crimes, and we only solve about 10% other than the smoking gun type homicides. That said, and along with what Mr. Jim said already, if we could wave a magic wand, we could utilize these people to use the intelligence they're using to commit the crime. If they could do good with that same intelligence, our jails would not be near as full, as long as we got parental involvement from the very beginning in the social issues and the culture. Your opinion, please, sir. Thank you.
Well, sure. Of course, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a magic wand. It'd be nice if we did. And, you know, people are, I mean, actually, if you look at the education levels of the people who are incarcerated, they're shockingly low. That's not to say that there might not be an innate intelligence that some of these people have that is being, you know, misdirected. But they're just, I mean, there's so many issues, education, family structure, and so on, that this issue touches upon. It's difficult, really, to come up with sort of an all-encompassing policy solution that would totally address this.
You note that a large number of these drug offenses carry mandatory minimum prison sentences, and numerous other crimes, such as firearm violations, aggravated battery, simple rape, simple kidnapping, carry no mandatory minimum sentences at all. So it seems there's a major disparity here.
Well, I agree, and that, of course, that's one of the key takeaways to this paper. Of course, by the way, for those of you who would like to see the paper, you can go to our website, pelicaninstitute.org, or the Pelican Post, and check it out. I think it's a well-documented, detailed paper, and I think you'll find it interesting.
297-5633 is your number. Kevin Kane of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy is with us, and T is near LSU. Good morning, T. You're on the air with Kevin.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
My question is, for those that are incarcerated, that have families that have long records of incarceration, is there anything being done to try to rehabilitate those people? Because they become a menace to society.
Sure. Well, that's always been a challenge, is how, what can be done to offer rehabilitation opportunities to those who are genuinely interested in them. I think one of the challenges we face in Louisiana, and I think this is really sort of central to understanding our challenges with incarceration, is, you know, back in the early 90s, rather than building more state prisons, the state started allowing local sheriffs to house state inmates, and then those local sheriffs get per diem money to house them. And that's become a big source of revenue for the local sheriffs. And typically at these local jails, there aren't a whole lot of kind of rehabilitation or education, training, counseling opportunities. In fact, you're much better off at Angola or one of the other state facilities if you're looking for those sorts of opportunities, which is kind of ironic because most of the people in those facilities, or many of them, will never get out and have the opportunity to make use of whatever it is they learn when they're there.
Your number, 877-217-5757 for Kevin Kane. Carol on Government Street. Carol, good morning.
Hi, yeah. I'm a social worker that's worked in public health, and I did work at Angola for a while. The basic issue here is that you have to start seeing about these children from birth in the home. A lot of nations in Europe provide daycare from birth on. It's preventative, okay? And, you know, it's much cheaper to prevent something than try to fix something. So if we have these kids in well-maintained daycare centers where they learn things, I think in one generation we could knock off half the crime.
Well, that's in. We could certainly do a whole program on what can we do to kind of keep more children from kind of going on the wrong path at an early age. I'm not sure that I agree with her specific recommendation there, but I do agree with her larger point, mm-hmm. which is that, I mean, we're facing tremendous social challenges that that I hope we can find a way to address, because that's certainly what drives a lot of this.
Well, the cost of the state budget, imagine if this is a $315 million increase in the last 20 years.
Right.
Imagine if that money were invested on healthcare or higher education.
Sure.
The advantages that other sectors of our society would have if we address this issue more readily.
Right. And I think one of the interesting things, too, is that states like Texas and also Georgia is another one of these conservative states that has embraced this approach. You know, what they've done is taken expected savings from reducing the incarceration rates and dedicated them to rehabilitation, counseling, training, et cetera, to make it less likely that people will recidivate. And I think that's a terrific approach that we ought to be looking at.
Dorothy on Goodwood. Dorothy, good morning. You're on with Kevin Kane.
Good morning. I wondered if there is more treatment-based approach for simple possession and things like that, or, you know, DWIs, because they used to throw people in jail and you know, just throw away the key.
Sure. I mean, and again, hard to get into real detail on that here, but yes, I mean, I think that's part of this larger approach, which is seeking alternative opportunities for alternative treatment for people, you know, rather than putting someone away for 20 or 30 years who may not pose any sort of real threat to society.
297-5633, a provocative report from the Pelican Institute for Public Policy, and we're visiting with Kevin Kane, the president of this group, which has now been around for 5 years, and it shows that Louisiana's prison population has almost doubled in 20 years. And when 40,000 people are in state prisons, we're talking about more people, for example, than attend Louisiana State University. So a whole lot of people.
Yeah, well, it's remarkable. And again, if you look at there's a graph in there kind of comparing Louisiana to our neighboring states. And, you know, we have more people incarcerated and have a higher crime rate.
Paul on I-10. Paul, good morning. You're on with Kevin.
Yes, thank you, Jim. And Kevin, you know, we have an experiment going on here in Baton Rouge with police intervening proactively in the, I think, 70805 zip code. And I think the results to date have been pretty good. Could you address that?
I don't know if I know enough about that particular experiment. All I'll say is that, you know, much of law enforcement, I mean, it's really a local concern. And so I do think you're seeing a lot of innovation and experimentation in cities like Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And we'll see what sort of fruit it yields.
I remember several years ago, many politicians were touting the three strikes and you're out mantra. If it's three nonviolent crimes, I think David Duke once said three strikes and you're dead. Where do you draw the line?
Well, you know, and I think that actually raises another issue, which is, again, traditionally law enforcement has been more of a local concern. And, you know, when politicians at the state or national level try to, you know, impose sort of a one-size-fits-all approach to it, whether it's three strikes, you're out, or something else. I think what ends up happening is we've got to go back and revisit it 10, 20 years later and find ways to undo the damage they've done.
Michael on Segan. Hi, Michael. You're on with Kevin Kane.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. My question is, who are the major players resisting these changes to prison reform, specifically both political or within the prison industry? Because it's my understanding that private prisons tend to make their profit based on having their beds full. So I would think they have a resistance to these reforms.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, as I mentioned before, I mean, we have this dynamic here where local sheriffs are effectively incentivized to have as many people in their facility as possible. I mean, that's their revenue stream. That's their budget. Now, sheriffs and district attorneys, I mean, they're political figures. They're elected, and you know, they need to keep their constituents safe. And frankly, from their perspective, I mean, you're always better off if you're you know, whether you're a legislator or a district attorney or a sheriff. I mean, tough on crime and is an easier sell than, you know, soft on crime. Mm-hmm. And so that's just a political reality we have to deal with. I think that what gives me reason for optimism is that, again, we can look at other states that have already implemented some of these changes and have experienced success. So we're really not talking about something that's radical or untested here.
Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on WRKF with Kevin Kane. Hi, Charles.
Here in Louisiana, we've cut so much from the social programs, and Tavis Smiley and Cornel West they've been talking about poverty and the link with crime, and I'd like to know what your report says about that. In addition, what are the cost incentives for wardens to actually reduce the recidivism rate? I mean, if we're going to grade high school, shouldn't we grade correctional facilities as well?
Well, let me touch on that second point first, because again, this goes back to the way we incentivize people. You know, this is not part of this report, but something that we are looking at, and I think could be very important to all this, is really revisiting the way that we do fund the local sheriffs, and maybe we can incentivize them in a different way. Whether we go to sort of a block grant approach, where we give them more money, but more of that money can be used for alternative programs and less for incarcerating as many people as possible. As far as his first point about the social programs, and I mean, again, that's really a whole separate issue and is not touched on in this paper.
297-5633. We'll spend a bit more time with Kevin Kane, president of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. In Maine, lawmakers have passed safety valve provisions that allow judges to depart below mandatory minimum sentences in certain instances, and in Rhode Island, legislators repealed mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenses. Kevin Kane and the Pelican Institute say that Louisiana could benefit from similar changes. 297-5633. Back in 90 seconds on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with Kevin Kane, president of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. We'll go to some emails if you would like to pose a question. InksterShow@WRKF.org, or you may reach us 297-5633. Here's one from Mark downtown. Attorney General Holder issued a new policy for federal prosecutors changing the criteria used to change minimum mandatory offenses. What can be done at the state level from the point of view of state prosecutors to do the same thing?
Sure. Well, that, you know, what's interesting is the sorts of reforms that Eric Holder is proposing are the sorts of things that they've already been doing in states like Texas, Georgia, South Carolina, and other states around the country. So, in a sense, they're kind of following the lead of states, and which is just further evidence that I think Louisiana needs to take a look at what other people are doing.
Last Sunday, this from Rick: I witnessed a child steal a bike from inside the Albertsons on Government. I chased him down, got the bike back. Why can't we reduce nonviolent sentences and allocate the funding to after-school programs that rather than babysit, teach these children technology, trades, business, and other real-world skills?
Sure. I mean, again, those sorts of, I mean, ideas are hard to argue with. Of course, the flip side of that is you can offer any number of programs. What if the kids don't show up? There's no easy way to kind of ensure that every child kind of learns a useful skill and stays on the straight and narrow. I mean, that's I think families are such a big part of that, and so it's difficult to sort of through a policy guarantee that no kids are going to turn out stealing bikes.
LW on the Bayou. Good morning, LW. You're on with Kevin Kane. Please be brief.
Great. Thanks. First of all, Kevin, thanks for taking up this call. Secondly, I'm an ex-con. I received 30 years for my first offense, which was possession of a narcotic with intent to distribute with no priors. Since I've gotten out after a 5.5-year stint, I've been crime-free and all of that good stuff, model citizens in the world for 9 years. My question is, do you think that 50% of the money spent on prison reform should be spent on the back half? And I ask that because I've experienced it's very, very difficult to reintegrate into society with so few opportunities, and I'd love to hear your comment off air.
Sure. I mean, we haven't put out sort of specific proposals for, you know, what you might spend on kind of different reentry programs. That is something we're looking at. That is definitely something that I think needs to be part of this larger approach to criminal justice reform. And again, looking, you know, going back to what some of the other states are doing, in Texas, just this past year, I think they passed a bill that basically offers some legal protections to businesses who hire ex-offenders, because that's one of the concerns of businesses often have is, well, if we hire some guy with a record, if he does something wrong, are we going to get sued, even if what he does has nothing to do with that prior crime? And so in Texas, they passed a bill that offers some protections to companies that hire ex-offenders. And what's really interesting is that in the state of Texas, the business community have become huge supporters of these reforms. In fact, I think it's the Texas Association of Business, which is basically the lobby equivalent in Texas, a very powerful group. I mean, they've made criminal justice reform one of their priority issues. And so when they're looking to identify what who they're going to endorse in races, that's one of the issues that they look at. So I think I think people in the business community here in Louisiana are starting to engage in this issue, and I think if that trend continues, then that might be something that makes these sorts of reforms more politically realistic.
Well, thank you, Kevin Kane, president of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. Appreciate the visit. Let's talk again soon.
Thank you.
Take care. Our guest now is Joe Henry, who, along with David Henry, his brother, they have co-authored Furious Cool, Richard Pryor in the World That Made Him. Richard Pryor was chain lightning to everything around him, writes Colum McCann. He shocked the world with human electricity. He blew all our comfortable balance to hell. And good morning to you, Joe Henry.
Good morning.
You state that Richard Pryor was arguably the single most influential performer of the second half of the 20th century. That's a huge statement.
It's a bold statement. I know it is.
Why?
But, you know, I think the evidence is there. You know, he was our, you know, my generation's Mark Twain, you know. To refer to him as simply a comedian is, you know, like saying that Miles Davis was just a trumpet player. You know, you have to acknowledge that not only was he supremely gifted, but in that beautiful alchemy of time, he arrived on a scene when we really needed him to. You know, it's not just about talent, it's about being there in a moment when your country needs you. You know, and I think Richard gave voice to a lot of anxiety. And he reflected back a lot of humanity to people who didn't know how to see it otherwise.
Well, since he departed, there have been many imitators and imposters, but I think it's fair to say there's nobody like Richard Pryor.
Well, true enough. And you find when you talk to anybody about him, most everybody who has any relationship to his work at all feels a very personal relationship to that work.
And he did some of his best work after he almost blew himself up, literally. He had a remarkable comeback from a near-death experience. How did that shape his career to follow?
Well, I would probably disagree with you quite a bit. I do not think his best work happened after the fire. I think he was quite changed after the fire. He became a bigger star. He did bigger broad-scale movies. But the days of him being a revolutionary were sort of behind him. You know, the farther he went into the mainstream as a performer, the more truncated his influence in some ways. And I don't say that to be critical. I just say that to imply that the thing that really interested my brother David and I in writing this book was not so much what he ultimately became, because a lot of people have a sense of, you know, who he was once he was a star and what happened to him. But we're really trying to look at, you know, how he arrived and changed the landscape and what landscape did he walk out of. You know, he put pieces together in a way that had never been assembled before, but those pieces came from somewhere. You know, my analogy, you know, frequently is if, you know, look at, you know, Bob Dylan as a cultural phenomenon and an artist who changed everything for all of us. And I should note, I'm a singer and a songwriter,
right,
first and foremost. That's what I do for a day job. And in the way that Bob sort of appeared at a time, where he was articulating things in a completely unique way, even if you could trace the elements back, that's really what we wanted to do with Richard. You know, where did the...
All right, hold tight. The book is Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Bade Him, and Joe Henry, along with his brother David, they're the co-authors of this book about a significant person on stage and beyond. You write about his time before his alleged freebasing incident. You say coffee, cigarettes, cocaine, and vodka notwithstanding, Richard's main sources of sustenance were Marvin Gaye's just-released LP What's Going On and the published speeches of Malcolm X. How was he influenced by others like Marvin Gaye and Malcolm X, big figures on the world scene like himself?
I think he took from them a real sense that he had to be involved. It was an electrifying time, and when he retreated to Berkeley early in his career and was listening to Marvin, for instance, and reading Malcolm and hanging out with people like Ishmael Reed and Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, he was being challenged all the time to make his work relevant, not just funny.
You note that in March of 77 that he and Chevy Chase and Johnny Carson were all on The Tonight Show together, a collision of big talents and big egos. What happened?
Well, you can pretty much imagine. But I think Richard took the upper hand. You know, he was, you know, casting no aspersions on Mr. Chase or Carson, of course. Richard was in a league by himself, and you couldn't miss it when you saw him next to anybody else.
And then there was Live on the Sunset Strip, one of the most famous filmings over two nights in December of 1981. But you say the first night was disastrous.
It was. He was not really ready to come back. You know, he had had this disastrous fire, which was in fact a suicide attempt, even though he denied that for years, or at least tried to pretend that it was an accident, at least for a while. And he was, I think, pushed to come back just because, you know, managers and such thought, you know, you're in the public eye in a way you've never been before. There's great sympathy for you. We've got to get you out there. But he really wasn't ready to come out and bare his soul at that moment. And it was a struggle, even though it's, you know, there are some galvanizing moments in that film. His earlier concert film, Live in Concert from 79 in Long Beach, is the masterpiece.
Well, he was a man who spoke about anything that he wanted to in any fashion he wished to. Here's an example of Richard Pryor. Now, we're always reluctant to to play him because you never know what you're going to get, but I think Kevin has listened to this one. This is Richard Pryor on the use of the N-word.
That's a word that's used to describe our own wretchedness, and we perpetuate it now because it's dead. That word's dead. We men and women, we come from the first people on the earth. You know?
Now, he became a film star as well, in addition to being such a wonderful performer on stage. And before we get to some of the movies, including one that was made here in Baton Rouge, Joe Henry, as far as his stage presence, his ability to deliver a line, tell a story, how does he compare with some of the greats?
Oh, I think he's among the greatest as far as, you know, when he was alone on a stage and could follow his own impulses and his amazing sense of improvisation and his own sense of rhythm. There's nobody that could touch him. The concert film I mentioned a moment ago from 79, it's still the greatest single piece of stand-up I think ever committed to film, and I defy anybody not to be moved by it.
Mm-hmm. Women loved him, and he returned the favor. He dated and was involved with some gorgeous starlets, including Pam Grier. You say in the book that he actually threw her out of his house. How could he do that?
You wouldn't be the first person to ask that question, and I'm not sure I've got a reasonable enough answer for you. I think suffice to say that, you know, as brilliant as he was not emotionally healthy, and it's not an excuse, but it's a window into it.
You write about the film that was produced right here in Baton Rouge, The Toy, that he did with Jackie Gleason, not one of his most memorable efforts, but certainly you've got two gods of the comic world who converged on the big screen.
Indeed, and I'll confess, it might sound strange for somebody who's just written a book about Richard Pryor. I've never been able to watch The Toy all the way through. I find it absolutely abhorrent. I just can't go there. Though I think Jackie Gleason, was a genius. I mean, I'm an enormous fan of his.
You can't go there. You can't go there because of the plot line, right?
I think it's offensive. Richard's daughter Elizabeth, who's a history professor in the East Coast, said that people come up to her all the time and say, "Oh, I loved your dad's movie, The Toy. That's my favorite movie." And she says, "Well, then you're a racist." And I think there's a good case to be made there. It was not his best movie, you know. I think he did it for the money, and he did it to be in the company of Jackie Gleason. But, anybody who would see that film and not bother to go back and see what Richard had done that led up to that big platform of a mainstream movie would never understand why someone like me thinks, he changed the world.
What was his best film performance in your estimation?
Well, my favorite from him as an actor is an early film that Paul Schrader made called Blue Collar with he and Harvey Keitel. You really get a sense of, he's really touching, and there's real depth to his dramatic performance, and I really wonder how that might have evolved had he been encouraged in that direction and if he'd been willing to make movies that he cared about creatively, not just ones that paid him a lot of money.
Well, the book is Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him, from Joe and David Henry, and Gloria Steinem, of all people, writes that Richard Pryor lives again in these pages with heart and grace, and witnessing the Henry show us why this comic and tragic genius changed the culture of this country when he could not change himself. You may be meeting or rediscovering Pryor, but he's likely to change you, too. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Joe
Thanks
Henry.
For having me.
Congrats on your fine work.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And today is the 7th day of November, and it's the 71st birthday of Johnny Ramostella, better known as Johnny Rivers, who performed at Baton Rouge High, where he went to school Saturday night, and put in a good 2 hours or more performing many of his hits and some songs that were not hits, but he still has it at his age, at 71, and it looks like he's got some years left in the tank. But it's hard to believe he's been around on the national scene for a half century. Kevin Gallagher has found this appearance from 1965, when Rivers was all of 22.
Another recording star from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, singing his terrific new hit, Baby, I Need Your Lovin', Johnny Rivers.
Baby, your love, baby, I need your love. Although you're never near,
Not bad for a kid who grew up at 4848 Convention Street on the Ed Sullivan Show. And Kevin Kane, our guest from the Pelican Institute of Public Policy, he is still with us. Your father worked with Ed Sullivan, didn't he?
Well, yeah, not directly. My dad worked for an advertising agency in the 1960s, Mad Men. He worked for a Madison Avenue advertising agency, and one of their clients was, well, they had cigarette companies as clients that advertised on Ed Sullivan. And so my father would work, well, would be there for the production of the show. So he was probably there when Johnny Rivers was performing.
1965. We'll be back tomorrow for Kevin Gallagher and Kevin Kane. I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.